We're now recording. And we have people appearing online. Good. So, you're writing down that, and I have to write down the number of people who are there. Good. Can you hear me okay online? The bad news is that it's in English. But, good. Okay, so. Does anybody either here or online have any questions before we start? This is your last chance to control the tutorial before I control the tutorial. No? We will be, good afternoon. We will be beginning to talk about the way of the world today, but I'm not really expecting you to know very much about the play. Since the course started yesterday or something, and you probably haven't read the entire play yet. But please try to read the play for next week. You'll get much more out of next week if you do so. As I think you may have learned from the first year, I hope, the secret to these courses is really to try to keep up, especially if you're high, especially if you can... especially if you can have sort of read the background stuff. If you can play the background stuff before the tutorial, like reading the work, etc., you will get infinitely more out of it, and you will feel very clever compared to your classmates who haven't. So do try to do that. I know you all have real lives of more important things, but to the extent that you can, that will be a good thing. Right, so does anybody know the date of The Way of the World? Not a good start. Guess? What was the last thing you remember about English literature?
Milton.
What about Milton? Paradise Lost. Do you remember the date of Paradise Lost? Good. So something like starting the second part of the 17th century. Can anybody be more specific? 1668. So starting the third of the century as such. So this is after that. This is one of those very few works of literature which has a very convenient date. The date of this play is 1700, straight out. So it shouldn't be difficult to remember. I think it was written in 1699, but the play was first performed in 1700. So that is very helpful of Congreve. Thank you, William Congreve. So basically there you've got a third of a century. Nothing very important can happen in a third of a century, obviously. How has life changed? How is Britain different between 1668 and 1700? Does this look like a scene from Paradise Lost? Why does this not look like something you might see in Paradise Lost? You see the photo? Could that photo be a picture, a scene from Paradise Lost? No. Why not? Okay, so it's... Right. So Paradise Lost is cosmic. It's talking about the history of humankind on a much bigger scale, etc. This is some type of comedy. It's presumably about contemporary society. It's close by and it's light. It's not heavy. And what type of writing is Paradise Lost? epic. Okay, so it's a secondary epic. This is not secondary epic, it's comic. So, do we know anything about Britain in the last third of the 17th century? So the restoration took place before Paradise Lost. 1660, yes, the formerly 1660. I think Cromwell died in 1658, so there was a sort of 2-year transition, but I'm pretty sure you're right that Charles II was crowned in 1660. So has Charles II been king for 50 years? It's a long time, right? Only. Right, so Charles II is the restoration, that's the arrival of, and did any other kings, queens after? James II, good. Okay, so we have Charles II, James II. What's interesting about James II? Good. Well, yeah, he was deposed by sort of Parliament who invited William of Orange to come and be king. Why? Did they like the colour? Or? Because of religion. Okay, so what was wrong with James's religion? Was he an atheist? Or? He was a Catholic. Good. Lots of history we have here. And the British are very intolerant.
Well, no, but they were created as religion and
right. I mean, but there was a feeling that Charles II was probably a secret Catholic. But, and he was doing quite a lot of fighting against the Dutch, who were Protestant, and so that wasn't a good idea for the people who were Protestant in England. But what did James do specifically that caused a revolution against him? Well, he founded an army of 30,000 Catholics and stationed them just outside London. And for some reason, Parliament thought this was a little bit threatening. So that was the specific thing that caused Parliament to say that they were going to depose him and introduce William of Orange as the new king. Why William of Orange? Whose daughter?
James.
Is it James's daughter or is it Charles's daughter? Maybe. I don't know. Okay. But here, so you have an English princess who is married to a royal from the Netherlands who is clearly Protestant. And we have at that point what is called the revolutionary settlement. So this process is called the Glorious Revolution. Why is it called glorious? What could be glorious about the revolution? Right, good. Nobody died in England. Let's be clear. A lot of people were killed in Ireland. But nobody died in England, which is all that they really cared about. Right. So we have a situation where basically James just ran away, which is very convenient. So as a result of that, we have what's called the Revolutionary Settlement, which introduces various ideas. For example, the rule, the law, that a Catholic cannot be king in England. What is the justification for this? I mean, from living in Spain in the 21st century, this sounds like really sort of nasty, theocratic rules. How could you justify that sort of law in England in the 18th century? or so, or in the 17th century.
What options do you have? If you decide, if you say, right, I've decided to be religious, what are my options
in England in the 17th century, in the last third of the 17th century? You can be a Catholic. You can be a some type of Protestant. What's the, how do we distinguish between Anglicans and other Protestants? Right, weird, strange things out there. Right, so
what we talk about Anglicanism. For you, they're all Protestants, from a Catholic, from a Spanish point of view. But from an English point of view, we have Anglicans, who are basically Catholics, but they don't accept the Pope. And they're what we call non-conformists. Okay, so non-conformists are Baptists. In a few years' time, there are Methodists, etc., etc. All of these weird and wacky things the Americans do, those are non-conformists. Okay?
How could you justify, in the late 17th century, the idea saying the monarch has to be Anglican? Anglican. How could you say, I'm a nice liberal person, but the monarch has to be Anglican? What justification could we have? Yeah, but tradition is hanging people. Tradition is slavery. Tradition is all sorts of nasty things. How can we actually justify
the fact that we have... Yes, that's good.
If anybody sees that a message has come up on the chat, do shout at me, because I'm tend to be looking in that direction, and I need to look in both directions. But because I'm a man, I can only do one thing at once, so I get confused. Perhaps, but I mean, that, because the Commonwealth, yeah, the interregnum, the Republican period, is sort of a little bit like what you have in Iran today. It is a theocracy, and it is basically the non-conformists in power. So, well, yeah, more or less, that'll do. The argument from the Anglicans, very, very convenient, I accept, but also a little bit true, is that if the Anglicans are in power, then there is toleration, what we call tolerance today, but they call it toleration, towards Catholics and towards non-conformists. If the non-conformists are in power, there's no toleration towards pretty much anybody else, especially the Catholics. And if the Catholics are in power, there's no toleration. Nasty things happen, like in Spain, Europe, with inquisitions and things like that. So if you want a free, pluralistic society, then the Anglicans have to be in power. Are there any other religious groups in Britain in 1680? The Jews, right, so good. The Jews were expelled by Edward I in the 14th century or sometime a long time ago. But they were invited back by Cromwell. Why were they invited back by Cromwell?
I guess it has something to do with money.
No, it has to do with religion. Cromwell wasn't interested in money. Cromwell was a very interesting dictator in the sense that he was very much about his religious views. He wasn't about keeping necessarily power for himself. He was very extreme in his religious views. He banned Christmas. That's not good. But he didn't make himself rich. He didn't favor his family or this. So he was actually quite a good dictator if you accept his extremism in terms of his views. No, the thing was that the second coming of Christ was going to be accompanied by the conversion of the Jews. So if you want to have a good second coming, you have to have your Jews with you so that they can be converted. It doesn't mean that there was pressure on them to convert. It just meant that they It was that was why they're invited back, if you like.
So it's a slightly bizarre reason, but it means that we have, at that point, a multicultural society. Okay? And to some extent, it is the first multicultural society. And it's not just me saying that. Voltaire, who was French, actually met Congreve when Congreve was an old man, described Britain around this time as the first modern society, in the sense that you had a situation where you would have living in the same streets, in the same areas, Catholics, Anglicans, Protestants, and Jews, and you would not necessarily know what religious affiliation somebody had. And this, if you like, is still one of the weird things about Britain. Britain is probably the most non-religious society in the world, partly because of this. Killed my microphone. Can you still hear me online? Or did I just kill the microphone? Maybe I killed it. Talk to me. Yes, good. Okay, I just knocked the microphone over. So you have a situation where there is that, but there is also when people are religious in Britain, they tend to be very privately religious. You will find out that somebody is one thing or another after knowing them for months and months and sometimes years. So it's very, very different from the United States. In the United States, you know how much somebody earns and what their religious denomination is in 5 minutes, because they're very religion outwards, but we're very religious inwards. And so that is one of the crucial differences between the two societies in that sort of sense. And it also just sort of means that if you quietly get on with your religion from this time to the present day, and you don't make it an issue with other people, it's not an issue. In Britain, not in Northern Ireland, different story. But that is a difference. Anything else that has happened between 1668 and 1700? So your teacher has sold you this idyllic country, which is a sort of utopia of toleration and all of these types of things. Anything a little bit worse, a little bit bad? Well, the American Revolution, we have 100 years to go before that happens. No, the American Revolution is at the end of the 18th century, not the beginning. Little thing called slavery. Britain starts to become enormously rich on the basis of enslaving Africans and what is called the Jamaica trade. So we have a situation where you take manufactured goods from British ports. You fill a ship full of manufactured goods, you take them to Africa, you buy slaves typically from Muslim merchants, who are the people who actually capture them, although a lot of Africans are also involved in the slave trade, it has to be said. Then the British take the slaves to Jamaica, which is why it's called the Jamaica trade. And they sell the slaves there and fill the ships up with tobacco and cotton and primary products and take those to England and start again. So you have a situation of profits, 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 profits. It's not a typical trading situation where you take something somewhere and just come back with an empty ship or whatever. It is massively profitable. It takes people perhaps a century to realize that this is perhaps morally wrong, mainly because it is so enormously profitable. But, I mean, that's not justifying it, just that is the way that things happen. Britain really starts to become the richest country in the world by the end of the century. And that means an awful lot of luxuries are being imported into the country. And so who's dominating the country? Who is dominating the country?
England.
Right, so, I mean, the British are dominating Britain. It's not the UK yet. The UK is 1807, I think, yeah. England, yeah. I mean, just after this play is written, we have the creation of, in 1707, I think, of Great Britain. And it's still England when this play is happening. Yes, England is dominating the three kingdoms or the four kingdoms or whatever. Yeah. Because we stole all of the silver and all of the gold, yes. But which group of people become dominant in this period? Yeah, the bourgeoisie. Okay. So,
in what we have with the Civil War, if you like, is one of the if you have a class perspective on the Civil War, we have a Civil War between the aristocracy, which is basically landed interests, and the bourgeoisie. And in one sense, yes, with the Restoration, a lot of the aristocrats come back. But they don't necessarily actually get all of their land returned, which is surprising. The control of the new monarchy, of the Stuart monarchy, is not as complete as you might expect. The new monarchy has been invited back by Parliament, which is basically the bourgeoisie, and in terms of money, they are the people who dominate. That is basically mining. There's quite a lot of mining going on, and we will see some mining interests, some coal interests in the literature. Manufactures, increasingly, and trade. And of course, an important part of that trade is the slave trade. We have to accept. Partly because the bourgeoisie are taking over, we also have the introduction of a serious tax system. Perhaps the first serious tax system in the world, or if not the first serious tax system since the Romans. Okay, so you have a punitive and an effective tax system. And that allows, as part of the same type of process, the creation of the Bank of England. Why is the Bank of England important? Well, the Bank of who does the Bank of England work for? For private investors, or does it? El Banco de España works for us, for the state. Yes, good. Okay. The reason that the British beat the French in the we talk about the Hundred Years' War in the Middle Ages. We have a sort of 150-year war now against the French. We're always fighting against the French. We have wars against the French from a couple of problems at this sort of period all the way through the 19th century until the end of Napoleon in 1815. So there's a long period of fighting against the French. We have what's called the Seven Years' War around the time that Paradise Lost is written, which is when the British effectively kick the French out of Canada and kick the French out of India. British control of North America and of India is established at this time. Hugely profitable. India is one of the richest parts of richest places in the world. And so controlling India, the British controlling India means there's lots of things to steal. So that's also a huge source of wealth. And the reason the British do it is not because they're a better military, not because they are better organized or whatever, but they have the Bank of England properly organized to finance public borrowing to pay for the war. And with time, a little bit, if you like the Americans and the Russians in the Cold War. The Americans had a better economy, and that's why they won the Cold War. The Soviet economy was rubbish. And that's why they lost. That is the long-term process that we have here. Right. What else did we say? We increasingly have what's called the state monopoly on violence. I mean,
We are very used to a society where the only people who are allowed to be violent are the police. Yeah, that's everybody in Spain knows that. They have a monopoly on violence. That isn't really necessarily the case in most of Europe until the modern period, whether you have what's it called, Curro Jiménez, like people, yeah, whether you have sort of banditry or whether you have local barons, local aristocrats who have a power base, etc., etc. That's fundamental changes. Yes, there are some highwaymen. Yes, there are some people robbing, you know, and there's quite a lot of ordinary crime in London as well. I'm not saying there's no crime, but the idea that you can have centres of power that are violent disappears. You can't have local pockets of power like you have. And that also creates a huge amount of stability. That is excellent for business. Okay. So you, because the bourgeoisie are in power, you have a country and an economy and a social organization that is geared towards making money. Yeah, money, if you like, is the new god. And you have increasingly the introduction of the Enlightenment. What is the Enlightenment? Enlightenment. Yes, okay, so the idea that you are getting rid of superstition and that we have increasingly either a deist position, so God exists but he's not very interested in what happens. Yeah. Most of what happens in life is determined by human actions rather than divine intervention. At the beginning of the century, you might have a Catholic worshipping place collapse, and everybody would be saying, look, that proves that God's a Protestant. Yeah? A little bit like when there's a plane crash going to Mecca, crazy people in Florida will say, that proves that God hates Muslims, or something like that. Ridiculous, superstitious thinking. That radically changes over this period of history. And we have found the foundation of things like the Royal Society. So we have Robert Boyle, we have Isaac Newton, we have all of these scientists sort of coming to the fore, and science becomes important. So, as I said, by the end of this sort of process, we have somebody like Voltaire coming to England and sort of saying, yes, this is the future. Yeah? I've seen the future and it works, sort of attitude. Good. So, what has changed in literature? What's the defining characteristic of Paradise Lost?
Religion.
Okay. So, Paradise Lost is the only great modern, in a literary sense, modern, work or English epic, yeah, in English literature. But it's also really pretty much the last great religious work in English literature. It's like 10 years later, you have Pilgrim's Progress, which is, a sort of slightly sort of medievally type of work from a non-conformist perspective, and is also great literature. But effectively, in those years, in the 1670s, is the last period of serious religious literature in English. Now, if you were studying last year and you remember anything, you will probably say, yeah, but there wasn't a great deal of religious literature last year. This is true, but this is because we have falsified your English course. Okay? Because we assume that most people, like we and almost any university in the world, assumes that you're more interested in secular works than you are in religious works. That is where most of the focus has been. If you were studying English literature in the, say, the late 19th century, the metaphysical poet you would have studied is George Herbert, who was writing almost exclusively religious works. So you might have studied George Herbert and a little bit of John Donne, especially the religious stuff of John Donne. When you were studying medieval literature, you would have studied Julian of Norwich and her Showings, which is a religious mystic thing, or other religious works at the time, etc., etc., etc. There has been a lot of religious literature. It's just we haven't been talking about it. From this point forwards, there is not a lot of religious literature. There are people writing religious things, but they're not considered great literature at the time or since. Okay? So we begin to have a fundamentally secular society, in part because money is important, but also in part because if you say, I'm going to write a piece of my great literary work from a particular religious perspective, Catholic, Anglican, Protestant, Jewish, you're losing most of the market. Yeah? Most people are not going to read a work from a particular religious standpoint which is not their own. So, if you want to get to as many people as possible, and let's face it, that's what most writers want to do, then it's much easier to write a non-religious work. That doesn't mean that people have stopped being religious at this time. It's really in the 19th century where the majority of people stopped going to church, and it's only really in the 20th century where the majority of English people say they're either non-religious or they believe in the Jedi and the religion around Star Wars and things like that. It's one of the major religions in Britain at the moment, supposedly. Something like the sixth largest religion in Britain. Weird people. So there is a relativization of religion, but as we will see when we look at the periodical essays, which are part of what's defining the culture at this time, it's sort of considered to be slightly absurd not to believe in God. But you do it almost on a private level, and it doesn't dominate your life. You just sort of, you know. And in some sense, it's quite similar to where I think a lot of Spanish people are now. You have God for funerals and maybe baptisms and for weddings, because the weddings are pretty like that, etc. You might have a confirmation, but it's not something, you know, very few people go to church every weekend or it dominates their lives. So that is increasingly the situation in Britain, especially in London, from this period onwards. And that has a huge effect on the way people tell stories. If you're telling a story in which God is front, back, and center, then the defining thing that's going to happen in the story is divine providence. Yeah? God decides how things work out. You're almost certainly going to write a story which is clearly and simply moral, in the sense that, you know, the good will do okay in the end, and the bad will be punished, and this sort of thing. And that is going to be the driving force in the story. And you can even, it's sort of acceptable to have things like in a play like The Winter's Tale or Cymbeline, in some of the late Shakespeare plays, you have a sort of deus ex machina. You have a situation where you have a divine intervention and the story changes radically because of the divine intervention. By this stage, that's just silly. And in the same ways, we would see that as just silly. Yeah. One of the things that is satisfying in modern literature, starting from around this time, is the idea that things happen for a reason. Yeah, but you have a process of cause and effect. It's not actually how life works. In most cases, things happen and then you may work out why, but you don't see the cause before the effect, etc. But that is what we expect from literature. And what governs the process, the processes of the narrative, are increasingly human laws and luck, replacing divine providence. And before divine providence, we had weird. If you remember, the Anglo-Saxons had their weird. And that's effectively the same sort of thing. That's a predetermined cosmos, which is what defines what's going to happen. This is much more a case of, if you like, intelligence, luck, and human laws. Good. Right. So, we come to the way of the world. So, this is a question which I will ask and no doubt answer myself. How is the way of the world different from what we've seen previously? Yeah, last year you saw lots and lots and lots of plays. Yeah, you saw Tamburlaine and a little bit, and the Spanish Tragedy, and Everyman a little bit, and Henry V, and King Lear, and Volpone, and The Tempest. That's a bit difficult, yes. So you saw lots of plays. How is this play different? Anybody online get that? No? Okay. So, several things have happened. The first thing, and this is good news for you, is that we no longer have verse. Yeah? It's written, plays are written in prose. And pretty much that is true from now on. In this degree, you're going to see very, very little theatre from now on. Yeah? You see this play this year. Next year, you will see the importance of being earnest. I have no idea what happens in the fourth year because I've never taught it. But you get like one play a year, so there's not a great deal of theatre. But I can tell you now that there is very little theatre in English which is in verse from now on. Yeah, it's partly to do with the newer concepts about making something verosimile, making something believable. And you may have noticed that people do not talk in verse normally. And so, what else? Which also explains a little bit about why they use prose.
Because they want
that
to reach a more general audience.
Okay, but I mean, if you've been brought up on plays which talk in verse, you're pretty used to it. It doesn't take very long. I have sat in a play, for example, a play called The Changeling, which is by somebody like Middleton, I think Middleton, and in Madrid, maybe 20 years ago, and in the break, in the middle of the play, there was an American woman crying in the row behind me because she didn't understand it. And I really wanted to sort of say, you just have to relax and flow with it and this sort of thing. It doesn't take a great deal of effort, but it can be a shock if you're not used to it. But if you speak English, it doesn't take very long to get used to it. Poor woman. She was not happy. But if you've gone to plays, you will be accustomed to it. What's the difference between The Tempest, Henry V, King Lear, Everyman, that sort of thing, and what you can see here, as you like it, and what you can see in this picture?
The tone.
Okay, but I mean, you saw, As You Like It, which is comedy, and there's sort of comedy in The Tempest. So they've been comedy before. How might she be different? Do you think she's radically different from the female members of the audience? No. It's portraying contemporary English society. Okay?
You had a situation, if you remember, with Shakespeare and Shakespeare's contemporaries, where
what was being portrayed was something foreign. To escape from the censorship, you weren't criticizing the state structure, because it's set in Denmark, or it's set in Spain, or it's set in Italy a lot, etc., etc. So nobody can feel offended. Or it's set in English history. Henry V, Agincourt, is nearly 200 years before Shakespeare writes Henry V. Slightly less, 180 years before Shakespeare writes Henry V. So again, it's not sort of dealing with contemporary society. Before that, medieval plays are about psychomachia, what happens in your head. So that's not realistic. This is another reason why we get rid of verse and we have people talking in prose. Because you might be able to imagine a Tamburlaine, yeah? He was talking in whatever Tamburlaine talked in, Uzbek or something like that. But he was talking in a foreign language anyway. Henry V was a king, you know, a medieval king, a long time ago, and he was a king, blah, blah, blah. So that he speaks different from us is normal. But if the person in the audience is basically like the person on the stage, then you would expect them to talk more or less similarly. So it makes little sense to have verse. It makes more sense to have prose. What else has changed? Could this be more or less a play from 100 years earlier by Shakespeare? Maybe not. Why not? Sorry? Exactly. Good. So, with the restoration of the monarchy, we have this terrible French habit of allowing women to perform on stage. Okay? That means that both women can obviously perform on stage. It's there's many more women in the audience. Because we're talking about private closed theatres without groundlings, etc., it's a much more socially respectable place. Remember that Shakespeare's theatre was full of the geese of the Bishop of Southwark. Who were the geese of the Bishop of Southwark? The local bishop in South London had a monopoly over prostitution. So there were prostitutes working in Shakespeare's theatre. This is now a place for the bourgeoisie and the aristocracy to mix. But this is not a place for common people. So we have women on stage, and that fundamentally changes the way that plays are written. Now plays normally have 50, they're pretty much 50-50. You have a similar number of lines for men and women and a similar number of important male and female characters. It's much more plays about society as a mixed social setting than the homosocial setting that you have in a lot of Shakespeare's plays. We're not writing plays about battles and emperors and conquest and all this nonsense. We're writing about people living their lives like you and me, and especially the aristocracy and the bourgeoisie. And so we have a mixture of people, and we have actresses on stage. There was, it has to be said, with the Restoration and the introduction of actresses on stage, there was a situation a little bit like the Destape in Spain in the late 1970s, early 1980s, where this was sort of seen as scandalous. You could see women's legs and terrible things like this. By the time we get to this play, they've sort of settled down. They're slightly more tranquil about all of this. But the introduction of women on stage was sort of a little bit scandalous to begin with, but then became much more sort of normalized, etc. So, numbers right. I have to write the number on the page. So we have that type of thing. And because this is part of restoration culture, other French ideas come in. There's much more emphasis on the elegance of plotting
So your story fits together rather nicely. Often in a play, in plays, I mean, even in great plays by Shakespeare, the story might not be that elegantly put together. There's a lot of emphasis on characterization, and, on the quality of the acting. Another, concept that seems to be introduced. We could say this a little bit about all literature, and it's quite a fun game if you want to play this game about all literature. But there is what is called proverbe dramatique. Qu'est-ce que c'est, proverbe dramatique? The idea that you can build a play around a series of proverbs or sayings. Okay? Now, it's actually quite relatively easy, as I will say, to say that, to encapsulate the essence of a play, of a novel, or whatever, in a proverb, if you have enough proverbs, and you sort of analyze it well enough. But we have, for example, in this play, a number of proverbs get reflected. How do I do this? This one, right? So, sorry, that's my what's new, that they are enjoying themselves in Vauxhall Gardens. And, another new thing. What else has changed? Men and women on stage, men and women in the audience, private theatres, and proscenium march. Yeah? Proscenium march? So instead of having theatre in the round, we have that. We have much more emphasis on scenery. Plays are much more expensive to produce. Much more emphasis on wearing clothes that look good and all this. I mean, Shakespeare was using the second-hand clothes of the aristocracy. But you would just, you know, have whatever clothes your local aristocrat could give you. Whereas here, there's much more emphasis on sort of dressing the part. And, can we move on? So we have things that, just, this will give you some idea of what the play is about. I've taken a couple of horrible memes from the internet, badly written and all sorts of things. He that would the daughter win, line number one, must with the mother first begin, rhyming couplet. What does that mean? Yes, so you, I mean, if you want to woo, if you want to court a woman, it's a good idea to enamor in one sense or another her mother or her mother figure, and then it will be relatively easy. Horribly sexist ideas, but that's what it means. Okay, so there is an element of that in this play. There is an element of lucky at cards, unlucky in love. Okay, which is reasonably self-explanatory. Yeah. We have a situation in the beginning where Mirabelle, the name which means nothing to you but will, it loses the cards to Fainall, but he actually wins the game of love, etc., etc. in the end of the play. Another one, I think. Yes. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. What does that mean? Well, not so much love forever, but yes, it changes on the back. So, a concept of beauty is subjective. Yeah. But some people find some people beauty, other people find other people beautiful. And there is an element of that here. Do I have more? Good. Marry in haste, repent at leisure. What does that mean? Right. So, I mean, in a modern sense, if you get too involved with somebody too quickly, that can be disastrous, because then if you want to get uninvolved, it gets complicated. In this type of society, of course, largely sex is determined by actually being married, and there's no serious types of birth control, so often having sex can lead directly to having children, and that's complicated. Blah, 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 blah. So we can sort of encapsulate a lot of the play in terms of those proverbs, and that's a very French thing to do. Good. Another thing that's happened, and here probably our best comparison is with Volpone, because Volpone is a play about people who are manipulative and interested in money and blah, 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 blah. And this play has a lot, number of similar themes. But in Volpone, we have people who are pretty much absolutely evil. Does anybody remember anything about Volpone? Maybe the name? A little bit? If you remember, there are people like Voltore, who, for example, threatens to burn his wife's face with acid. So really unpleasant man. There are people like Bonario and Thelia, who are sort of pure and lovely and perfect, and they couldn't do anything wrong. That is, I say, you can disagree with me, that is not really what people are like in real life. Yeah? In real life, people have a bit of good and a bit of bad, and they tend to be mixed together. Real people, real society is not made up of absolutes. Yeah? People generally try to be sort of good according to sort of their value systems, and some of them are better at being good than others, but nobody's absolutely good and nobody's absolutely evil. And so in this play, we have lots of somewhat ambiguous moral decisions. We tend to see that the people who are bad are largely weak, etc., etc. They're not necessarily people who are awful people. I mean, Fainall and Marwood are not very nice, but we can sort of see a little bit why they're not very nice. And Millamont and Mirabelle, our sort of central couple, have some good qualities. They're able to be their own people, not be completely dominated by the society, but there are also aspects of them which are not so attractive. So it's much more realistic in that sort of sense, and I think much more enjoyable, because we can sort of see real people, if you like, almost for the first time. And we will see that these types of qualities coming out in theatre are also influential on the rise of the modern novel, which is probably the most important thing that happens in this term, between now and Christmas, if you like. It's the rise of the novel as an important genre. So, how are we doing for time? We run out of time. We still have time. Good. Reminds me of Balzac's. Yes, definitely. There's all sorts of French influences crawling in, although Balzac's a bit later. But Molinaire is hugely, hugely influential on all of this English drama at this time. People like Wycherley and people like that. What type of play is The Way of the Wild? Any words we can use to describe it? Is it a history play? Okay, so it's a comedy. It's a good start. What type of comedy is it? Sorry? Okay, I mean, it doesn't have to have it. I mean, Volpone doesn't have a very happy ending. What tends to happen in comedy is that the people who are redeemable are reincorporated into society, and the people who are unredeemable are expelled from society, and that definitely happens here. It's also funny, that helps. But can we be more specific about the type of comedy? The good thing is that you've read practically nothing about this play. If you'd read a little bit about this play, you would all be shouting, it's a restoration comedy. Does that ring a bell, the word restoration comedy, that term? Good. Okay, you haven't been influenced by that. You haven't been corrupted by that idea. What's wrong with the expression restoration comedy? for this blame? Well, it's a stupid term. William Congreve had not been born when the Restoration happened. The Restoration happened 40 years before this play. So if you imagine somebody writing a play now and describing it as a play, Filibista or something like that.
Referring to a historical event 40 years earlier, it would be ridiculous. Yes?
And really, the comedy that has been produced in those 40 years has undergone some pretty radical changes. In the first period of that, of the comedy produced after the Restoration, I mean, there's elements in common. There tends not to be verse, tends to be prose. There are women on stage, all of these types of things. But it tends to be much more scandalous, much more sexual, much more, if you like, provocative. There's no references to morality at all. And so you begin to have quite a lot of people of a sort of more puritanical persuasion, sort of again saying we should close all the theatres and all this type of thing. In the second period of what might be called the Restoration comedy, it becomes much more nuanced. You tend to have a situation where good wins out in the end, where people who more or less behave themselves are the people who are successful in the end. And one of the major figures that we have in this type of comedy is the rake. Does anybody know what a rake is? Well, if you look it up on... Most of my time I'm teaching people who are 18, 19, and 20, and they will have their computers open, and they will be looking it up on Google, and they will say Rastrillo without thinking. And rake does mean Rastrillo, it does not mean Rastrillo here. A rake is a disreputable man, a disreputable womanizer, the sort of person who gets women pregnant, blah, 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 without marrying them, etc. And in the first period of Restoration comedy, a lot of the heroes of the plays are rakes. They are these sorts of frivolous men who are only interested in sex and things. What comes to the fore in the second period of comedy in the second half of the 17th century is what we can describe as the reformed rake. So somebody who's had a period of behaving a little bit like that, but has settled down a bit and is now a bit more mature and therefore may have some bad reputation, and that's to some extent what we have with Mirabel. But by this stage his intentions aren't good. So we're moving away from sort of a scandalous celebration of immoral behavior to a situation where there is some immoral behavior. It can be sort of funny, but in the end, a sort of more moral behavior wins out. So there are different ways we could describe this. We could call it a comedy of manners. Now, comedy of manners, we probably use more to talk about, novels, but there's no reason why we can't use comedy of manners to talk about theater. And what is a comedy of manners? What does comedy of manners mean? Sort of, yeah. Normal bourgeois citizens, not everybody else. So 90% of the population, no, but not aristocracy and monarchs. Normal bourgeois people, people without titles, but generally speaking with a lot of money. So typically, I mean, a great example of a comedy of manners would be a little book called Pride and Prejudice. Okay? Pride and Prejudice is describing how people function in society, the right sort of people, not everybody else, and the sort of silly rules that they live by, and the rules that are restrictive on young people's behavior and young people's attempts to escape from those rules. That's standard comedy of manners stuff. And that's pretty much what we have here. We could also call this a comedy of wit. Uh-oh, that word. Okay, fine. We've had an hour. Good. Okay. The machine's talking to me.
It's a little bit like my fridge. My fridge tells me that I should not have it open too long, etc. It's my fridge. I pay the electricity. You stay open as long as I say. So, what does wit mean? Do you remember from last year? Well, witty means funny. But usually witty means sort of funny with some sort of intellectual element. So it's not sort of people banging their heads funny. It's with verbal humor and this type of thing, some sort of sophistication. And wit is related to words like wisdom and witness and all those sorts of words, wise. So there is the idea of intellectual as well as human, sort of intellectual human. Often that means, especially in Britain, as you know what we're like, that means irony. Yeah? Irony. Ooh, British people. So, people being passive aggressive, very, very British, etc. That is, those are standard elements of this, and comedy of wit is comedy where we have, an interesting wordplay, people really being funnier than they can be in real life. You can probably say, off the cuff, maybe one funny thing in a 2-hour period. In these types of plays, it's exactly what we get later with Oscar Wilde. People are just saying constantly things that are funny, play on words, inverting concepts, blah, 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 blah. Real life people are not like that. Even with a lot of coffee, they're not like that. We could also describe this as a revenge comedy. Okay, so there is a revenge theme running through this, but it's not the type of situation where something terrible has happened, somebody's been killed, you have a revenger who gets revenge but of course has to die. Yeah, do you remember Spanish tragedy and all of that sort of stuff? Yes. Here with a revenge comedy, somebody does something wrong, often sexual, and somebody gets their own back on them, and they will maybe be ostracized from society, but they're not going to be killed for it, by the playwright. So it's a revenge comedy in that sort of sense. And it's also what we could call proto-sentimental comedy. Now, one of the main reasons that we don't study any plays between 1700 and 1894 is because they're awful. Okay? English theatre, I mean, you have sort of, for example, English poetry, English novels, once the novel starts, it's sort of, you know, there are slightly better periods and slightly worse periods, but there are people writing pretty good novels most of the time. There are people writing pretty good poetry most of the time, etc. English theatre is sort of, what is, maybe 25 years from 1590 to 1615. Nothing, you don't miss anything before or after, really. You can live without it. You have, in that period of time, you have maybe 50 great plays and nothing really of importance before and very little of importance afterwards. You then have this play, which is the only masterpiece of revenge comedy. I mean, there are some other quite good revenge comedy type, restoration comedy type plays, but this is the masterpiece of it. You have the first musical, which is called The Beggar's Opera, written in 1726, I think, completely in isolation. It founds the genre of musicals, but nothing really comes of it until the 1950s. And then you have nothing really until you get to Oscar Wilde, a bit of George Bernard Shaw, and then, I mean, the 20th century is significantly better. But there are huge periods of British history, of English history, where the theatre is rubbish, absolute rubbish. And you can happily forget about it. And that's basically what happens between 1700, or if you want to include musical theatre, 1726 and 1894.
1894, with something like The Importance of Being Earnest, which is a masterpiece, obviously. So, yes, what we have basically in most of the 18th century is what's called sentimental comedy, which is about sort of people falling in love, and it's very pretty and very, very boring. And it's not, you know, that's just, it's all very moral. You just, it has no interest for us today. There's just nothing to get hold of. There's nothing that you could find interesting. Perhaps the complete immorality of the world of the first generation Restoration comedy is not necessarily completely satisfying for us today. But the fact that you have people misbehaving, but eventually the people who deserve to end up okay are okay at the end of this play, makes it satisfying. When it's just boring people who are just very, very morally upright, who win out in the end, it's just, I don't care. And that's what we get in the rest of the century. With a small exception, there is a little window of 7 years where we have people like Goldsmith and Sheridan writing plays like School for Scandal, The Rivals, She Stoops to Conquer. As 1770 to 1777, there are some excellent plays. For some reason, we don't sell them, but they do exist in a very, very small window, and then nothing again. And they are very, very much in the tradition of this, of Comedy of Manners. So, it's a little bit strange that it should happen like that, but that's what happens. One of the reasons that happens is because putting on a play becomes very expensive. And so, a little bit probably like what happens today in Spain, I imagine. It's always probably, you know, you're going to do better getting something famous by Lorca or by Shakespeare or by Molière, which people have heard of, and they're, oh, I better see that because that's good. I've heard that's good. Rather than the completely new play, it's very difficult to promote by word of mouth. There doesn't tend to be very much, there's not money for marketing for plays. So, you know, lots of people are writing plays in Spain today. A lot of them don't get produced just because there's not the money for them, or they get produced in little theatres where they get quietly forgotten. If you think about what is theatrically successful in Spain today, which is musicals, they're musicals which are based on either very, very popular novels or they're based on films. Now, why you would want to watch a musical of a film that you've already seen, you know, whatever. Well, I don't know. I hate musicals. It doesn't matter. But that idea of we will take something which already exists, maybe change it a little bit, but that is what's going to be commercially successful, is a huge problem, and means that people who are writing, who are good writers, are not going to dedicate very much time to theatre because there's no money to be made in theatre. Increasingly, as the century progresses, you can earn a lot of money by writing novels. So why are you going to waste your time writing theatre? It doesn't make sense to do it. Right. There are, however, a number of ways in which... backtrack a bit. Another thing which we have, which is hugely different from before, is we have an almost total absence of classical allusions. It's very important if you're Shakespeare, it's very, very, very important if you're Ben Jonson, to be demonstrating constantly that you've read lots of things by Romans and by Greeks, and to be constantly making Latin allusions, because there is a sort of complex about British culture. Yeah? Before Shakespeare's generation, English literature was like one guy, which is Chaucer. Yeah? Beowulf had been lost. Nobody knew that Beowulf existed. So the only person who was considered at all on an international scale before Shakespeare really was Chaucer. And so people are a little bit embarrassed about English culture. And so if you can write a play which makes all sorts of references to Ovid and to Horace and to all of these people, or even to some Greek people, then that's going to be a good thing. That shows that you're cultured and that, okay, you're writing in English, which is a second-class language, but you do know about real culture. Okay?
All of that has been lost by this stage. Britain is the richest country in the world. It's beginning to even produce painters. Believe it or not, there are actually painters who are English and are more or less quite good, like Reynolds or like Gainsborough or whatever. So we're beginning actually to have a real culture, not a second-class culture, which is slightly embarrassed because French culture is so much better, Italian culture is so much better, Spanish culture is so much better. And so where there are allusions in a play like this, they are allusions to English culture. You will find direct allusions to Volpone. You will find direct allusions to The Tempest. And you will find direct allusions to poets who you've never ever heard of before, like Saka or Waller, who are basically metaphysical poets that period. Well, cavalier poets more, but from the beginning of the century, of the 17th century. So people can be referential to English culture, and that means something. Whereas in the previous centuries, everything was referring back to classical culture. I mean, Chaucer was doing the same thing, because classical culture was serious culture. Right, but we do have a certain level of continuation from what we've had previously. So we have the humour really is very much a continuation of the comedies written by Beaumont and Fletcher. Does anybody know who Beaumont and Fletcher were? Fletcher co-wrote a couple of plays with Shakespeare, and Beaumont and Fletcher took over The King's Men when Shakespeare retired. So they were writing above all tragic comedies. A lot of their comedy, a little bit like with Ben Jonson, revolved around stock characters. What are stock characters? Yeah? Stock characters are easily identifiable archetypes. So, one of the ways that hopefully you've begun to analyze literature as a result of last year is in archetypal theory. Yeah, so you have different figures which you will see reflected, and then you will be interested in how the writer has slightly transformed these figures to individualize them. So typically, for example, in Beaumont and Fletcher or Jonson, you get fops. Does anybody know what a fop is? A fop? F-O-P? A fop is a dandy. So a young man who is frivolous, is very concerned about his appearance, has too much money, doesn't work, etc. Is a dandy or a fop. You have pedants, somebody who's pedantic very much. And you have women are typically vain. Yeah, women are worried about their appearance. Why are women worried about their appearance? Because that's how they're judged by men. Completely unfair system. But we judge women by their appearance, and then when they worry about their appearance, we say, ooh, you're vain. Ridiculous, but that is the way these things work. And we see a lot of that repeated. We have figures like the battle axe. What's a battle axe? Has anybody seen The Importance of Being Earnest? Do you remember Lady Bracknell? So, you have a situation of having a mature woman who has some power and likes to control everybody. Okay? And that is what we call a battle axe. So the sort of domineering older woman. Very, very funny. We have exactly that type of figure in Lady Wishforce in this play. Yeah, we have an older woman who is in control of the money of the nubile, the marriageable younger women, and uses her power to sort of decide people's fates.
So it's a typical situation of somebody with having power without a great deal of responsibility. And in this case, we have a woman who is not conscious of the generational difference. So she sees herself as a competitor lover. Well, so, I mean, tends to make a fool of herself in that sort of sense, which you don't have with Lady Bracken in the books of being honest. There are those sorts of things in play. Of course, with all of these things, yeah, we have to be aware of the historical period and not judge it by our own values, because you couldn't really read any literature if you did that. Et cetera. So we have all of these types of figures, above all, Fox and Pevens and Vain Women, that have been carried over from previous literature. We have this, very much from Volpone, we have the idea of a society dominated by materialism. The situation, in theory at least, in Volpone, is this is this terrible, outlandish society which is Venice. Yeah. Venice is sort of godless. It's a long way from the Pope, and the money is the god of Venice. And it's weird, it's not like us, etc. 100 years later, that Venice is us, that Venice is what's happening in English society. Everybody is obsessed about getting control of money. Why particularly? There's a particular feature of British society, certainly compared to Italian society. I don't honestly know in terms of Spain at this time, so if you're interested, find out. You can do that for yourselves. There is a situation where to be somebody, to be a gentleman or to be a lady, the defining characteristic is that you don't work. So, in this sense, this society is almost the opposite of our society nowadays. Somebody who is an adult below retirement age who just lives off their money and maybe off interviews on some this type of thing. We consider parasites, we consider, generally speaking, I think most of society considers them negatively, shall we say. Yeah? Somebody who, vivere rentas, is maybe wonderfully attractive as a fantasy, but if we know somebody who's doing that, we think they're wasting their life, they're useless, they're parasites, etc., etc. In this society, a lot of these people, probably very well educated, perfectly capable, a lot of them, but they're trapped. Because the moment you actually do any bloody work, you lose your social status. It's absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, and this system basically finally collapses in the second half of the 19th century. But through the entire, until Christmas this year, that is dominating society, and it's a huge problem. And there's quite a lot of evidence that people at the time are aware of this and how ridiculous it is. They're not aware enough to actually change it. And that goes both for men and for women. And so, if you have some sort of title, you have some sort of claim to be a gentleman or a lady, you can't work. The only way you can get hold of a lot of money is by marrying the right sort of person. But at the same time, we increasingly have a society where families have much less control. In Shakespeare's time, you have Lady Capulet deciding, Lady Capulet and presumably Lord Capulet as well, even though he doesn't really appear. Deciding who Juliet has to marry. Yeah. Juliet has to marry Paris, blah, blah, blah. And anything else, any Romeos, are a fantasy. Yeah. And you can have intense love, etc., etc. All of that's going to end in disaster. Increasingly, from this time forward, there is what we would recognize as a concept of romantic love, of youngish people marrying somebody who they want to marry, who they find attractive. Bizarre modern ideas like that. So we have that, but at the same time we have all sorts of people who are in this position of desperately trying to maintain their status, because once you've lost your status, you've lost your status. Yeah, once you've done any work, you're dead to me. And I mean, we can see all sorts of people who are in danger, something like Pride and Prejudice, who are in danger of falling off the edge of being part of society. And you become invisible. Yeah? You just stop existing if you fall out of society. It's hideous. It's a horrible way of organizing society. It's what they do. And it is interesting from a literary point of view, although it's horrible. It's more individualized, but with this concept that you can't work. You can't work. The worst thing you can do in your life is do any work, because that means you're dirty in your hands or something. There are a few ways out of this. One way out of it is for men to become a soldier, to join the military. That's something that used to be an officer, which is the only thing that really matters, costs money. You know, you have to buy your place as an officer. So there has to be somebody who's willing to invest a little bit of money to make you an officer. But then you can maintain some sort of status and work, because you will get paid for being a member of the military. Of course, you can join the church. That is not as limiting sexually as it is in Spain, obviously, because church men can get married in Britain at this time. But it's still, you know, quite a big decision. Because, I mean, you have to have some sort of moral behavior and blah, 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 if you are a churchman. More is expected of you as a churchman than if you're not. Interestingly, one of the big options for women, if they need to earn money but don't want to lose their status as ladies, is, any idea? Well, yeah, obviously, yeah, getting married. But if you want to be sort of have an independent income. Yeah, but you're going to be in this weird state where you're a semi-servant. You're not quite a servant. The servants will probably reject you. But you're not really part of the family, they'll reject you as well. Very, very isolating, not a very nice job, and you have to look after children, which is awful. So, not a good thing in the government. That's falling out. You're no longer somebody. Curiously, writing novels. Yeah? Writing novels. If you have a successful novel, we will see a woman near the end of the century, at the end of the 18th century, called Fanny Burney. And Fanny Burney, Frances Burney, writes a novel for which she earns as much money as she would earn in 100 years as a governess. Yeah? So, there's all sorts of people writing novels and not all of them are successful. But if you write a really successful novel like Evelinda, it's like way better than being a governess. There are people like at the end of the 17th century. Okay, what opinion? Oh, don't know, no, I don't know. Don't be silly. I'm in the middle of a class. There are people at the end of the 17th century, like Aphra Behn, who are writing theatre as well as novellas, as well as short novels, things like Uranoku and things like that. And she's able to live as a professional writer. The problem with theatre is it's very public. Yeah? If you write novels, you can call yourself J.K. Rowling, and nobody knows initially if you're a man or a woman. Yeah? The Brontes can write under pseudonyms, and male pseudonyms. You can call yourself George Eliot and be a woman, and nobody knows originally, etc., etc. So if you there is an anonymity in novels, which means that there's no sort of, there can't be any type of public scandal, because nobody knows you. And if they know it's you, once your novel is accepted as great literature, well, it doesn't matter. Yeah? So, literature becomes an enormous way out for women. And one of the characteristics of men is that they don't think. Yeah? They're not strategic thinkers. And so, often we will leave opportunities, and women will take advantage of those opportunities, and by the time we realize, it's too late. So, for example, in 1860, there was a law about pharmacies. And the idiotic men in Parliament, all men, forgot to say you have to be a man to be a pharmacist in the law. It didn't say that. And so in the next 5 years, all over the country, women started becoming pharmacists because it was a profession. And by the time the men realized, hey, we've made a mistake here, it was too late. And so pharmacy became one of the first major female professions. And for example, in Spain, it's still a female-dominated profession, curiously. I don't know the actual situation in Spain, but that's why it happened in Britain. And in the 18th century, novels don't matter. Novels are not serious. So there was little bits of art which women were allowed to do. Women were allowed to do watercolors, because watercolors are sort of silly things, yeah? Whereas oil painting is for serious people like men. And you have these sorts of rules in society. And novels were nothing, yeah? Serious literature was poetry, and to a second lesser extent, theatre. And then, little by little, throughout the 18th century and into the 19th century, novels became literature. If you talk to somebody about literature, they will assume you're studying primarily novels. And it was too late, because the greatest novels in the English language had been written by people like Elizabeth Gaskell, Anne Bronte, and Jane Austen, etc., etc., etc. So you couldn't suddenly say, well, women can't write novels, we won't let them, because they obviously could write novels. And those, so we have a very sort of similar process, very obviously very prosaic in the case of pharmacies, but these types of things happen, and that's very much what we see happening with novels. I mean, obviously there are a couple of men who write novels like Dickens in the 19th century, but really it is a genre that is dominated by women. Blah, 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 blah. So we've run out of time. Excuse me, Nick, could you please point me to a good film that portrays that period, that atmosphere of the late 17th and 18th century? Interesting. There is a version of Moll Flanders which has Morgan Freeman in it. And because it has Morgan Freeman in it, it must be good. It's not very closely connected with the novel Moll Flanders, which we will study. But it does give quite a good image of that society. I can't remember who the female lead is, unfortunately. There are many more films about this sort of period of the Romantics, that which is the end of the 18th century rather than the beginning. I'll keep thinking about it, and if something brilliant comes up, which it probably won't, I will tell you. I mean, it's halfway through the century. You have a lot of things written by Fielding and Richardson. So you will have things like Barry Lyndon. It's a little bit later, but you will get some idea of that sort of society. There's a film version of Tom Jones, not the Welsh singer, the novel Tom Jones. So some of those types of films, I think, will give you a reasonably good idea. I mean, Barry Lyndon, is a lot of it is about continental Europe and about him being at war. But watch the film of Tom Jones. That will give you a bit of an idea. And I'll see if I can think of anything better. Okay, right. Well, I have to go and teach another class. So, good to see you all. Please read up about, you have a footnoted version of the play. Has everybody found everything in, whatever it's called, the new thing? What's it called? Anyway, yes. Yes, you found the notes, you found the footnoted version of the play, etc. Good. Okay, well, lots of reading to do. And how do I turn this off? Off. Off? Are you off now?